I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to episode number 175 of The Functional Nerds.
Yes, that is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude. He's also a Hugo Award winner for the SF Signal website and a Hugo Award nominee for the SF Signal podcast. This podcast doesn't get nominated for Hugos, but, you know, we have fun anyway.
We've had some Parsec noms.
Oh, yeah, we've got that, yeah. Yeah, well, maybe we'll do a run for an award this year, but nah, we won't do that. Anyway, you can check out his website, atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I'm a songwriter and a composer. You can check out my music over at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter, at johnanilio. And today, we are excited to be nominated by Philip K. Dick Award-nominated author. did I say joined by or did I say
you
nominated?
You said nominated by.
Oh, well, see, I'm tired too. Joined by Philip K. Dick Award nominee. Is that right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anne Leckie. Anne is has published short stories in Subterranean Magazine, Strange Horizons, and Realms of Fantasy. Her short story History and Glory was reprinted in Science Fiction, the Best of the Year, 2007 edition. And as well as a waitress, a receptionist, a rodman, and a land surveying crew, and a recording engineer, which I'm going to want to talk a little bit about that. And she lives in St. Louis, Missouri, and is also the author of Ancillary Justice, which is really doing the rounds right now in the science fiction and fantasy community. And I'm about three quarters of the way through it, and the hype is justified, people. and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, right in your bio there, it says that you were a recording engineer. What was that like? I'm a little bit interested in that, and I'm sure Patrick is too, because we do a little bit of that here ourselves. So what was that work like?
Well, so what that was, that's almost kind of a dodge. What that was part of a job. I worked for New Music Circle, which is a local nonprofit that presents avant-garde music concerts. And so my job, I was like the one paid employee of the nonprofit. And so I bought plane tickets for musicians and I arranged venues and I wrote out press releases. And one of the other things I did, of course, was I recorded all the concerts. And at least one group actually turned that into an album and credited me as the recording engineer. So I'm in some big database of recording engineers of people with credits on albums, even though that's the only thing I ever did. And so I did a bunch of recording for that. That was a lot of fun. I'm not sure that I would qualify as like an expert or could possibly get a real job doing that, but it was something I did and it was fun, and I thought it would be kind of fun to put it in my bio that was different from the other things.
Well, I mean, if you had to set up mics and make sure you got levels and successfully recorded them, I think that counts.
That was basically what I did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a lot of it. It's just, I mean, you'd be surprised how many people don't set up the mics properly and don't get proper levels and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There is a challenge to it. So how avant-garde are we talking with this music, you know, because that's how out there are we getting with some of the avant-garde stuff?
What? It really depended. There was the board had like a committee and they would list of people send in tapes and whatnot. And so some of it would be actually fairly accessible. Stephen Scott's Bode Piano Ensemble, which I highly recommend. Really accessible. Immediately, obviously, pretty sounding stuff. Got us some huge audiences. Then again, we'd have some of the free improv people who would be playing on things that you wouldn't think of as instruments or playing saxophones or whatever, but it wouldn't sound anything like that. And we would have people walking out of those concerts, even though there were only 12 people in the audience. So it was actually a really interesting range. It was kind of neat to hear all the different stuff. It was really a lot of fun.
Well, I think, you know, as a musician, I think that even though I don't necessarily like listening to a lot of avant-garde music, I think in any art, it's important. I think somebody has to be there on the edges, seeing where the edges are, I think, you know, and I think it's really important and beneficial for all artists, even if your tastes run more towards the mainstream, to have people out there on the fringe a little bit. And I used to go to this place called the Knitting Factory in New York quite a lot, which has a lot of avant-garde music. And one of the shows I saw was this guy, Elliot Sharp, who's a guitar player, and he does lots of different stuff. But the one night that I saw him, it was very out, very like no rhythmic structure, no melodic structure. It was him and a drummer just making noise for about 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, like, when is this going to go into a tune? You know, like, I know they're doing some noise to set it up here. And it was like, nope, 50 minutes of noise.
Yep.
And my favorite part of that was that when it was done, because it was a part of a three-act bill, at the end of that, they played AC/DC's Back in Black. Like the most accessible rock song that you can have, just to kind of cleanse everybody's palate. So I did enjoy that, but it was very good. But that's great. That's really cool that you had that experience. So, well, let us get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And you're our guest. Why don't you go first with your pick of the week?
I think I was sort of trying to think what I would recommend. I often have a hard time with that kind of thing because it's difficult to remember, you know, then somebody will remind me and go, oh yeah. But very recently, I read a novel by Sophia Samatar called A Stranger in Alondria, which I strongly, strongly recommend. I know some people have been kind of talking it up, but I think it could use some more attention. I think more people could read it. It's really beautifully written. It's a really neat novel. I think folks should check it out.
Great. Well, can you give us the name of the novel and the name of the author one more time so our readers can go check that out and put it in the show notes?
It's called A Stranger in Alondria. It's all O's, except for the A at the end, of course. Sophia Samatar is the author. I kind of feel like she's kind of been around a while because I've seen some fabulous short fiction from her, but this is her first novel. But I've also heard she's eligible for the Campbell, so she can't have been publishing short fiction for as long as I feel like she has. So she must have just made a strong impression on me. But I think her work is really fabulous.
Excellent, excellent. Very good. Well, I'm going to pick one of the novels that I just finished, and that is Three Parts Dead by Max Gladstone. He's got the second book of that series is out now, which I think is called Two Serpents Rise, and I know book three is coming out in the new year as well. And it is just a really original fantasy where it doesn't seem very fantasy at all on the surface. He talks a lot about he makes this parallel between law and lawyers and all the rules that go into a magic system in a fantasy novel. So it's almost like a courtroom drama, but set in this very unique fantasy world. So it's just like a really interesting take. I've never read anything like it before, and I know he's getting some pretty good press these days for it anyway, but I recommend it. I really enjoyed it. I finished that a couple weeks ago, and so once again, that is Max Gladstone, and the book is Three Parts Dead, and I think, depending on when people are listening to this, I think if you are an ebook reader, I believe that is a heavily, because it's the first in a series, it's maybe like $2.99 or $3.99 up on for the Kindle, if you have a Kindle subscription, which I read on my iPad, so it's well worth the $3 or $4 that you're going to spend on that. So yeah, Max Gladstone, Three Parts Dead. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
Isn't Max a Campbell nominee last year?
I think he was. I believe so. He was nominated Merle Lafferty and Chuck Wendig and lots
yeah,
of
I met
our
him.
Other friends
okay.
too.
Then I met him at WorldCon. He gets a fine form in a tiara.
Oh, okay. Well, we're gonna have him on in a future episode, so we can ask him about his tiara wearing when we talk to him.
This last year it was unique because they all went out and got tiaras.
Like you do.
Oh, did they? So not just the winner? Because yes. I know, of course, there's a Campbell tiara.
Yes.
But...
No, they all went out and got tiaras and wore
them. Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
They bonded. It was really cool. So I got to hang out with some of them, and that was a lot of fun. My pick this week is a graphic novel from Image. It's called Planetoid Volume 1, and it's from Ken Gehring. And I actually reviewed this over on Kirkus. I like it. What I've been doing for Kirkus is I've been trying to find comic books and graphic novels that have nothing to do with superheroes.
Hmm.
And this was very cool. It's you know, the solitary person crash lands on the planet and discovers all kinds of weird stuff going on there kind of stuff. And the cover's great. and it just has all kinds of great stuff going on in there. And I just highly recommend it. It's very different, and it's a contained story in volume one. So when there is a volume two, it's going to take place in the same universe, but it's not going to be the same characters. So this is a contained story, and very, very good sci-fi stuff.
Cool. Is that now, have you read Saga yet, Patrick?
I have read Saga Volume 1, yes.
Yeah, I have that. I read the first couple issues, and then I just went and got the the graphic novel mm-hmm. of Volume 1. I haven't had a chance. Unfortunately, like, my comic reading is, that's, you know, you don't have time for everything, and like, that tends to fall by the wayside. If I have time, I usually prefer to read novels, although I love comics and I love graphic novels, but that seems to be, you know, when you that seems to be what falls by the wayside for me. But I loved the first two issues of that, of Saga, and everyone seems to really like Saga too. Yes. I don't know, it's a really unique sci-fi space opera kind of a mm-hmm. thing. So
and that's why I'm trying to find other stuff for people to read, because mm-hmm. of what you just said. It's like, well, comic books is what falls by the wayside, but if I can mm-hmm. find you different unique things to read that is gonna challenge you and be something that's so completely different that you're gonna enjoy it, you know, it's not the same old Marvel mm-hmm. superhero crap, you know, or Justice League crap, you know, it doesn't star Wolverine or Batman. Mm-hmm. It's worth your time, trust me.
Yeah. Well, all that stuff is the problem with all the superhero stuff is that, you know, there's so much history that, mm-hmm. you know, creators are kind of shackled by that history and what they can and can't do. So when you have, you know, something like Saga, where it's Brian Vaughn is the name of the mm-hmm. the writer of that, you know, it's his original story. He's mm-hmm. just telling his story. He doesn't have to be like, oh, well, you know, in issue 122 of Wolverine, that, so I can't go against that. You know, I just creatively, I imagine as a writer, it really ties your hands when you have all of that history.
I'm not much of a comics person, but didn't they essentially get around that by like making multiple universes and alternate histories mm-hmm. and erasing things? And so they can restart. But mm-hmm. I think the superhero thing, I mean, I know a lot of folks really enjoy it, but it's kind of, you can play it out and you want to do something different after a while. You know?
Well, and then there's tons of stories out there of writers who are brought on to books and they start going in different directions and they start doing cool things. And then suddenly Marvel or DC comes at them and says, oh, and by the way, we're doing a massive crossover and it's going to touch your book and you need to do this, 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 and this. And it destroys everything they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have control over the whole universe.
No.
Yeah.
And in this case, Ken Gehring, I did a little research on him, and he worked on this book for years before he ever sold it to Image.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he did tons of work on it. He really fleshed it out. He's got some great characters. He's got the artwork is wonderful. And he eventually, you know, sold it to them and at a convention. So he really did control this, and he is intending to do more stuff in this universe, which is great because, again, it's his.
Very cool. Very cool. Mm-hmm. I'll have to check that out. Cool. Well, let us get on to our main topic today, which is I'm Patrick. I really feel good about myself because I'm in kind of a good groove where I'm actually reading everybody's book again. when we first started the podcast, I really tried to read everybody's book that we had on, and then eventually I can't read a book a week. It just wasn't.
It was too much. Yeah.
It was too much, and then so for a long time it was very rare that I did. In the last couple of episodes, I've read most people's book, so I'm very happy so we can actually talk where I don't want to get spoilery about the book, which once again, for people who maybe aren't familiar with it, it is called Ancillary Justice, and it is really, in addition to the Philip K. Dick Award nominee, now I'm all up in my head about it, Patrick, thanks. it's just really getting a lot of buzz in our community, and rightly so, and a lot of times when I'm finished reading a book, I will tweet or Facebook out what I'm thinking of reading next. And when I, before I started reading Anne's book, I tweeted that out there, and overwhelmingly people were like, oh, go read Ancillary Justice. Like, and I have a lot of author friends too, like Django Wexler was like, those other books are good too. Read Ancillary Justice first. So it came highly, highly recommended, and rightly so. And I think one of the reasons why, the book is so highly recommended is it's very, you know, I don't even know what to say about it because it's it's being billed as a space opera, and I think that's in some circles, at least anyway, and I think that's accurate, but it's really different than any kind of space opera that I've read before. And just the ideas of AI that are used in it, and I know almost every review and everything else I've read of the book really talks about how Anne used gender in the book, and I hope you're not sick of talking about that, Anne, because everything I've read about it really talks about that. But I think it's worth talking about because I find myself reading it and really loving that aspect of it. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the book and maybe even talk about, you know, touch upon some of the ideas of gender, which I'm sure was something in your mind that you wanted to write about because it does seem like a main theme of the book.
Yeah, well, in some ways, the gender thing was sort of accidental because I had just started off a while ago saying, oh, I'd like to write a society that doesn't care about gender. And then how do you do that on the page? Because when you're writing in English, it's possible, but difficult to talk about somebody for a protracted period of time without mentioning their gender because English kind of forces it on you. And so I thought of different ways to do it and ended up deciding to just use she for everybody. And I was kind of afraid that it would make the book difficult to read and that nobody would want to buy the book. And I said, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. So it wasn't necessarily meant to be a major theme of the book, but as the way that it played out, it ended up being very important, which I guess is kind of the way those things happen. I've been really pleased at the number of people who have really enjoyed that and kind of interested at all the various different interpretations that people have of what it was, why does Breck always use she? And it's really been interesting to me what the different ways that people talk about that and the discussions around that. I've really enjoyed that.
I don't know if Anne is aware, but over on SF Signal on the podcast, her book was picked as one of the favorites for 2013 by multiple people on the podcast. And it was your use of gender roles and pronouns or lack thereof that was one of the things that was so intriguing, I believe, to Sarah Chorn, Paul Weimer, Carl Anderson, and Aaron Sykes. We talked about it quite a bit back in December because they said it was such a great concept and they just really loved the execution of it. So kudos to you.
Well, thank you.
Well, and I'll tell you from being almost finished with the book now, I didn't find it confusing at all. I read one review that said that they were a little confused by it. I'm not confused by it because I think the whole point is that you're not supposed to think about the gender. I think that's the point. And really, being almost about three quarters of the way done, I did find myself a couple times in recent chapters being like, oh, wait a minute, I think this character is a man, I think. Like, I think earlier on, someone like an outsider that's not Breck mentioned that this was a man, but now I'm not sure. And like, oh, that's good though, because I don't care that if it's a man or a woman, like it's, which I guess was the whole point. And I loved that about it because a lot of my reading, all the fiction I read, or just about all the fiction I read, is science fiction or fantasy. And I do tend to veer towards the fantasy side and the sort of epic fantasy side. And a lot of epic fantasy is very, if there's a male protagonist, I have to say a lot of times I am very, that resonates with me, that, you know, mm-hmm. man overcoming, you know, what, you know, doing whatever, you know, sort of your man hero's journey stuff is. And I like all of that stuff and that resonates with me. And a lot of my favorite books are like that. And this is not like that. It is really just about the characters and about, you know, stripping away a lot of what gender is and just sort of what being a person is like. And it's sort of on top of that, then we do have the idea of sort of consciousness, like what is consciousness and what is a person, because some of the characters in the books are, you know, are they part of the ship's AI? Are they human? So I'm sure that had a lot to, so where, you know, what were your thoughts on sort of mixing the AI and sort of the gender stuff? Where, you know, what were your thoughts sort of leading into that? Was that sort of by accident to the AI, or was that intended from the beginning?
Well, the AI was kind of an accident as well. The universe is one that, you know, maybe not everybody does this, but I always assume everybody does this, how you kind of play with different things in your head. You make up little stories or you put different things together. And this is one that I've been sort of putting putting things on and putting things on. Oh, this looks shiny. I'll shove that in there. And so the sort of meat puppet idea, which is sort of Borg-like. I don't know if I was thinking of the Borg in particular, but obviously that's there in the background. That's in a lot of our heads in the background. Was sort of, I thought, well, that's a cool idea. I'll shove that in there. But the more that I played with it, the more it became obvious that it wasn't, it couldn't just be a simple matter of, oh, you take over this person's brain. It can't work that way. At least not if identity is something sort of floating separate from you, then I guess it could. But I couldn't. And so the more I thought about it, I'm like, well, how does that work? And the more I asked that question, the more psychology and neurological stuff that I read, the more complicated it got. And this it really kind of unsettling, actually. And the more that affected how I was portraying it in the novel. And actually, the more afraid I became that I wouldn't be able to do it. But finally, I just said, no, I'm just going to have to sit down and write it. And it's going to have to be as good as it's going to be, you know.
And John, I like how when you were talking about all that stuff, and you just kept grinning ear to ear.
it's just because, you know, I don't know if you know, by description, if I would have you know, picked a book like this, because, you know, I just like, well, I don't know if that's not typically what I read, but that's one of the things that's great about it. But kind of getting back to what Anne was saying about you know, the AI and the Borg-like and everything. I listened to a podcast recently. It was from a couple of months ago, but it was Moby, the electronic musician Moby. He was being interviewed on Chris Hardwick's podcast, The Nerdist, and they were both, I guess, philosophy majors in college.
That must have been a conversation.
Yeah, it was a very interesting conversation. They were talking a lot about the brain and a lot about and actually from, I think you would enjoy that discussion, and it was from a few months ago. So if you check out the Nerdist podcast, it's from, I think, December, early December that it was.
Oh, I'll have to check that out.
And they talked a lot about the brain and like really how all we have is our own consciousness. And they talked a lot about Descartes and the whole I think therefore I am and just this, whatever's going on in our brain is really kind of what we have. We don't really know anything else for sure. And, you know, it gets into all of these different things. And I think these are kind of ideas that are you think about while you're reading Ancillary Justice. It's like, well, not only is there the gender thing, but there is the, well, who is this now? Like, because there is, it is sort of for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of a hive mind where you have all of the different ancillaries and the ship, and it's like, well, who is who and who, what's part of who, and we together, are we linked in it? And it really gets you thinking about what goes on in our heads. I certainly thought about it. So, I mean, now were those ideas that you had, were you thinking a little bit about these almost like this Descartes kind of thing of like what's going on in our brain is really all we have, or where did, you know, where else did it launch from?
Well, definitely. I know a lot of people have different things that they really feel are true about the universe and human nature and stuff. And I tend to take the position that we are our bodies, that there isn't a separate thing that, you know, like there isn't a soul that's separable from us that you could pull apart from your body and say, oh, that's you. So if you change your brain, you're changing who you are. If you change your body drastically, you're changing who you are. But then, like you say, that leads to the next question. Well, who are you exactly? And if you can segment different parts off, or what is all of that? And when you look at it, I mean, is there really just one person there, or what is a person? You know, what is all of that? And that was the unsettling part. The more I looked at questions of things that happen with split brain patients or with certain kinds of brain damage, the more kind of scary it gets to think about how tenuous your identity and your sense of yourself actually is. And so, yeah, that definitely led into a lot of what I was thinking about that character.
And, you know, to sort of build upon that, another aspect of the book that I found very interesting was the use of religion in the book, which isn't apparent right away and not something I've seen a lot of other people talk about when they talk about the book, but the various religions that are sort of make up the fabric of the universe of Ancillary Justice. And I always find that really fascinating, both our real life religions and our religions in our fiction as well. And one of the things that I liked about what you did with the book was that there was the main religion of the, how would you pronounce the?
The Rachai?
Rachai, good. Pronounced it right in my head, though. Although most authors I talked to were like, "Oh, you can pronounce it any way you want."
Well,
that's
pretty much. I tried to make it kind of intuitive, though, for most of it, so that by and large, most people are going to get it pretty right.
Good, good. So the main religion of the Rachai, and as they sort of sweep through the universe and sort of take on other peoples and cultures. I like how it's just sort of on the surface that they fold in other religions into what they're doing, because I think that's what really happens. If you look over history, that has certainly happened, but it's while it's happening, it doesn't seem like that's what's happening. You know, I mean, obviously you can get into discussions of, Christianity sort of taking on pagan practices and sort of folding that into their, because, you know, I think if you talk to, and not to get into a big religious discussion about anything, but just if you talk to some people, they're just like, oh, no, this is our religion, and this is what it is, and this is what it always was. But when you look at history, it's not really the way it works. It is this whole folding in of other. And so was that something that you did on purpose? Or again, was that just sort of like, oh, well, these people should have religion, so what should we do about that?
Well, I kind of, the folding in of other religions, as you point out, has a lot of historic parallels. And in fact, I think the Greeks and Romans did it very explicitly. They would actually say, oh, this god so-and-so, actually, that's Athena, or actually, that's, you know, Jove, or they would make that equation very deliberately. As far as, I myself am not a religious person, but religion is so deeply intertwined in human cultures that I find it difficult to believe that in the future will somehow evolve beyond it. It will just disappear. And so I wanted to make cultures that felt like they were real, but also that really respected the genuine complexity and the sincerity of a lot of people's real religious beliefs. Religions aren't real ones, aren't one-dimensional things. And so I was trying to make a situation that felt real, where religion was an important part of some people's lives and maybe not others. It was impacting people's cultures very strongly, maybe even if people didn't necessarily believe in them. So I wanted to build something like that.
I still remember on SF Signal, I had an interview, I think it was with Tracy Hickman, where he wrote a book, and it was about a Mormon in space, and his publisher came back and said, you have to take the Mormonism out because there are no Mormons in space in the future.
Oh, you know, I had a friend who I was talking to who she wrote a novel and sent it to a crit group, and she had, now she's going to listen to this and she's going to say, you didn't get this right. Where different religious groups were colonizing Mars, and one was a set of Buddhists, and they like stole something from another colony, and a bunch of her partners were like, but Buddhists wouldn't do that.
I've been having some internal issues with critique groups lately in my own head, simply because I'm always amazed at what people tell you you can't do. So, for example, in my space opera, I was told that my main character cannot be wearing tidy whities because they won't have those in the future.
Oh!
And I'm like, really?
People have some really odd assumptions. I've heard from other critique partners, this was ages ago, things like on space stations, nobody would wear clothes because you could regulate the temperature, as though the only reason you wear clothes is to keep warm. You know, I think there are some really odd assumptions behind some of the things people say you can and can't do, or that certainly will or won't happen in the future. It's like, well, first of all, we don't know.
Right.
Secondly, I'm making it up. That's why it's fiction. And thirdly, wow, you've revealed some interesting assumptions about the world in this thing that you've said.
Yeah, it is very interesting. So one of the things I did want to ask, so this is your debut novel, and it was funny, one of my blogger friends, Justin Landon, who writes the Staffers Book Review blog, he wrote a, you know, top, he's had his end of the year kind of posts, and he had his top five debuts, and a lot of people were like, oh, hello, Ancillary Justice. He's like, wait till tomorrow. He's like, wait till tomorrow.
That.
So he did vote yours like his favorite book of the year. So congrats on that. So I will ask, as we start to wrap it up here, will there be other books in this universe coming out?
Yes, in fact, the sequel to Ancillary Justice has been turned in to my editors.
Oh, excellent.
I have a plethora of editors because the deal was for US and UK at the same time, so I actually have a US editor and a UK editor. And so I haven't got notes back, but those are coming soon. And then, of course, there'll be a third one that I'm starting to write now. Beyond that, I don't know, but, you know, it's a universe I've spent a lot of time on, so I probably don't mind spending a lot more time in it. I don't think I would want to keep writing about Breck beyond three books. I think that would probably be – everybody would get sick of her pretty quickly.
There does seem to be – I don't know what the number is, but there does seem to be a number of books where – in terms of a series where it's like people want more, but then it does get to the point where I know, you know, I'm part of this community and where it's like, wow, that he's writing another one of those. Like, this is like book 19 at this point.
The sweet spot is 14.
14. Okay.
I'm
so there you go.
I'm a big fan of CJ Cherry's Foreigner books. Excuse me. And that's a series that has become essentially endless. But the thing is that if you like those books, I feel kind of ambivalent when people say, oh, the long series, it's so ridiculous. And I sort of understand that, and I'm sure writers probably get tired of it. It wouldn't surprise me if C.J. Cherry was getting tired of writing Foreigner books. But at the same time, I love that universe and the characters so much. I could, you know, it would be a book about Bren Cameron reading the Shedgedon phone directory, and I'd be sitting there turning the pages going, wow, this is great, you know. So I think there's kind of a pull on both sides. There's a, oh, it's going on too long. And then there's, but we love it so much. You know, it's hard to.
The guy who wrote the Spencer novels, Parker?
Robert.
Yeah.
Parker?
He talked about that, how he could write those novels in his sleep. And he continued to do it because it paid the bills.
Yeah.
And he would write, you know, other books just to kind of break out and do other stuff. But yeah, he always went back to Spencer.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's a problem that a lot of authors wish they had, where they could just knock out a book and make a lot of money and then write what they wanted, and maybe it wasn't successful, but, you know, they got what they wanted to. So, well, okay, so Anne, let's run down. So obviously Ancillary Justice is out, and if you have not read it yet, I highly recommend you go and pick that up. Anne's website, I believe, is annlecky.com, which is L-E-C-K-I-E.
That is correct.
And I believe your Twitter is @Ann_Lecky. Am I right there?
Oh, that is also correct.
I got two right in a row, Patrick. I never do that. So that's where you can find her online. Do you have any upcoming con appearances that people could check you out at?
I do not. I plan on going to WISCON. I generally go to WISCON. And the rest of my travel plans, I will probably go to a couple other cons this year. But I'm not sure what those are just yet. I'm waiting for other things to settle out before I figure out what my travel plans will be. But certainly FimeCon, and I'm hoping a couple other places this year.
Great. How about World Fantasy? That's, I believe, in Washington, D.C. this year. I know that's the one that I'm looking at to go to next. I know that's sometimes that's got a big turnout. Not always, but depends on when it is. But I know that's in November, I believe. That's in D.C.
November. That's one of the ones that I have never been to a World Fantasy, and it would be really awesome to go. And that's one of the ones that is on my list of, depending on how things play
out,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, because it is, unless you're the guest of honor, it's, you know, you got to spend a few bucks to get out there sometime, you know, so it's...
You got kids and got to line up things with school schedules and
I was this close to going to Confusion, which is in Detroit, and that's in January, and it was just one of those, you know, yeah, it's not too bad, but it's like, By the time you add everything up, the flight and the hotel, and even if they're not too bad, and then, well, do you need a cab? And then you got to eat while you're there? And it's like, well, the next thing you know, it's like you just spent almost $1,000 on a weekend. And
it's always, for me, $1,000 at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if it's coming in at like $500-$600, by the time food and cab and everything else, it's like, oh yeah, well there you go. So yeah, you do have to kind of weigh the value of it. But well, very good. So is there anything else that you'd like people to know about before we sign off for the week?
Not that I can think of.
Well, congratulations with the success of the book. I wish
Thank you
continued
so much.
Success with it. For me this week, again, you just check out my music over at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter @johnanilio, and Patrick's website is atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter @atfmb. And Patrick, what else is going on this week?
I haven't been blogging or anything because I've been sick. I do want to mention, I don't have a whole lot of details yet, but in April, I'm going to be at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference as sort of the official podcaster.
Ooh, very
and
good.
I'll be doing interviews with different folks. Chuck Wendig's going to be there. Gail Carriger's going to be there. Jim Lyons, I think, is going to be there. And I'll be doing some stuff with them and recording some different things and probably pushing that out over on SF Signal. So that's April 25th through 27th. If you're in the Colorado area, it's a great conference. It gets you access to a lot of agents and editors and different things. And it's different. It's not like a science fiction con. It's not like a literary con. It's a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And, cool. I'm going to be there. So.
Cool. That sounds. Hey, if I was close, I would go to that too. Well, very good. Okay. Well, thanks everyone for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time.
Emmanuel Kant was a real pissant who was very rarely stable. I Jigger was a boozy beggar who could drink you under the table. David Hume could out-consume Schopenhauer and Hegel. And Wittgenstein was a beery swine who was just a slosser slave. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.